Let's come back to order. Mr. Wells, I see you, and I saw that Ms. Williams was with us earlier, but I don't see her now. There she is. A good early morning to you. All right, I think Commissioner Brown Bland, we're back to you.
All right. Let's see. Yep, I'm on. I was at the point where I was about to ask Mr. Wells for a late filed exhibit on those who he spoke with in DEP to learn about the history of coal ash management with that utility. Is that something you can provide for me, Mr. Wells?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. I would like to know who they are and what their capacities were, the reasons that you spoke to them in essence.
Very well.
All right. And Ms. Williams, just a small question for you, and that is, you mentioned that DEP was ahead of the curve on groundwater monitoring back, earlier and ahead of others in the industry. Why didn't that translate into an understanding that some type of liner was required to stop or at least contain CCRs, back sometime earlier in the 70s or 80s?
Commissioner, there just wasn't information at that point to suggest that a liner was required to protect groundwater in the 70s and 80s. And in fact, even when EPA issued its proposed rule in 2010, EPA had three potential options that it was going to select for the final rule. One of those options was a Subtitle C approach that would have resulted in liners. But the second option was a Subtitle D approach that would have allowed existing ponds without liners to operate for five additional years. And the third approach was what was called a Subtitle D prime approach. And that approach allowed entities to continue to use unlined ash basins for the remainder of their useful life. So even as late as 2010, when EPA was putting out its proposed rule on this, it had not yet determined that it was necessary across the board to close unlined ponds prior to the end of their useful life. So the information just wasn't there. And a lot of looking had been done at the results of individual ponds. So it remained a site-specific issue up until the rule was finalized.
And as a site-specific issue and otherwise, there's no indication that EPA or any regulator would have been opposed to a liner. Is that right? A liner of some sort?
Well, I don't think I guess in my view, that's probably not the right question. EPA wouldn't have necessarily been opposed, but the question is, did EPA think it was necessary to adequately protect groundwater? And
regardless of what EPA may have thought, it's more about what the company knew, right? And if they were ahead of the curve in the groundwater monitoring, they could take some steps that were out ahead of EPA, couldn't they not?
They could have
and the EPA wouldn't have been opposed to.
If the data supported that, but that's why they were in a process of collecting extensive groundwater data and working with DEQ to determine what the data demonstrated. And so that process was not complete and wasn't even close to being complete until after the time that CAMA was issued and the final CCR was issued.
All right, thank you. Mr. Wells, last couple of questions. Has the, to your knowledge, has the commission ever denied DEP or DEC any of their costs for the groundwater monitoring at their CCR basins?
I do not have specific knowledge on that.
All right, that's all my questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Brown-Bland. Commissioner Gray, you're up next.
Thank you, sir. I think I'm going to let the panel pass.
All right. Chair Mitchell.
I have no questions.
All right, we'll move to Commissioner Duffley.
I have no questions.
Commissioner Hughes.
None for me.
Commissioner McKissick.
I have no questions.
All right, Ms. Williams, I've got just one for you. You referenced in your testimony yesterday, and you had also referenced it back in the testimony you gave in the Duke Energy Carolinas, a 2001 EPRI report. When I've searched for that, the only thing I have come up with is a report that's titled Evaluation of Remedial Actions at an Unlined Coal Ash Site. Is that the correct title of the report?
No, it's not. I'm not sure I have the complete title, but we can certainly make sure that we provide the document.
I appreciate that greatly. I would make a request to your counsel that report be submitted as a late filed exhibit. I was just searching on the EPRI site for 2001 reports related to coal ash, and that's the only one I turned up. So if you can provide that to council, I would appreciate it.
Sure. It's a report that looks at three different ash pond closures and talks about whether or not cover is helpful over and above dewatering.
Actually, I did see that one. Thank you. It was three case studies. I had understood it to be a more generic report. It's three case studies on a cap in place closure. I think for the record, Mr. Marzo, it would still be good to get that in the records, a late file exhibit, even though I now know which one Ms. Williams was referencing.
We'll get that to you, Commissioner Clawfelter.
Thank you very much. And that's all I have. So we're at the point of questions on the commission questions, and I'll start with Ms. Lee.
No questions, Commissioner.
Thank you. Ms. Townsend.
No questions, Commissioner.
Okay. Public staff.
No questions.
All right, Mr. Marzo, back to you.
Commissioner Clawfelter, just a few. Starting with you, Mr. Wells, you were asked some questions by Commissioner Brown-Bland regarding your testimony. And how much of it was based upon your review of historical documents versus your direct personal knowledge. Do you recall those questions? You're on mute.
I do.
Okay. And did you testify in docket E7 sub 1146, which was DE Carolina's 2017 rate case?
I did.
Okay. And did you also testify in docket E2 sub 1142, which was DE Progress's 2017 rate case?
I did.
And did you also testify most recently in docket E7 sub 1214, which is DE Carolina's current rate case?
Yes, I did.
And obviously you're here again on behalf of DE Progress, correct?
I am. Okay.
And in all the cases that I just identified, has the company's historical compliance with regulations regarding the treatment and disposal of coal ash costs been a central issue for cost recovery?
They have. It has been a central issue.
And is it fair to say that you've lived and breathed the record, the documents and the exhibits in all of these cases that you've been a part of?
I have in a number of ways. I want to be clear, it beyond just document review, it also, you know, my involvement and my knowledge has been based on a number of factors. Certainly one is since I've been with the company, my scope of responsibilities required interaction in the coal ash area with folks and people, employees that are knowledgeable and that manage these issues, whether it's compliance or ash management at each of the different sites. I have visited all of the sites. I visited many sites numerous times. In my current capacity, I'm responsible for our environmental obligations across the board. And that's involved a need to have a clear understanding of the history of compliance, history of operations, you know, what the current state is a reflection of that history, interaction with senior regulators. And I'm also responsible for a large team of environmental specialists and subject matter experts. So understanding, including groundwater, surface water, all of our compliance obligations across the fleet. So those teams report up to me and as part of my decision-making. history, historical documents, knowledgeable personnel, including the reliance on the current expertise in each of these areas is relevant and informative to my need to make good decisions. So that whole picture is part of my understanding of the history. So it's the historical documents, which I've looked at length. And then it's also those interactions with people and regulators and the records that are relevant to my need for to do my work today.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. And we just talked a moment ago that you had testified in the prior D Carolinas and prior D Progresses rate cases. Did the commission find your testimony persuasive in those cases?
They did cite to my testimony and indicated they found it persuasive.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wells. Mr. Wells, in response to a question from Commissioner Brown Bland, you discussed the process of identification, assessment, and remediation. And in regards to those three steps, when dealing with the complex issues like assessing groundwater impacts, does it take time to get through each of those steps that you discussed?
It does, and it can vary significantly with the complexity of the site and what the data is telling you and whether that data is indicating a potential risk that needs to be addressed very quickly or whether additional monitoring is appropriate to continue to investigate and understand the appropriate actions, if any, with respect to corrective action. So the detection process, you know, I've referred to it as detection, assessment, and then corrective action. Those are commonly sort of three areas, you know, almost within almost any groundwater regulatory regime that you find those three steps, and sometimes using different terms. But in essence, the detection is the early wells to see if you're detecting anything that might warrant assessment. The detection monitoring that went on with the company began through at late 70s at, again, Roxborough is where that started, but then into the 80s with Sutton and then Weatherspoon and Robinson in the 90s. And throughout that detection period at those facilities where that monitoring was installed, they were not seeing something that triggered additional assessment, with the exception of Sutton, which had the chloride issue, which drove additional work to understand that chloride issue, which ultimately led to more wells in 86, more wells in 90, and ultimately was determined to be the cooling, you know, the cooling pond. The corrective action ended up being moving the intake for the cooling pond versus the ash pond being the source. But in any event, that was the detection that occurred over those years, and there were not indicators of a need for additional assessment. In fact, the regulators reduced the monitoring requirement at two of those facilities in terms of periodicity, because under the permit requirement to monitor, they had reduced because there was not an indication of an issue that was being detected with respect to groundwater. Then you move into the 2000s, that detection monitoring is expanded to all of the sites through the USWAG voluntary monitoring. That data began to get more and more review, 2009, 2010, where we began to move into an assessment. That's when we were beginning to see indications that warranted additional assessment to understand what is the extent we're seeing an impact. We believe we have an impact. What's the extent of the assessment? So now the assessment is a broader look. More wells, many wells. An assessment can be, that's very iterative. It is very much you put in some wells, you look at the data that you get back, then you may need to install additional wells, but ultimately you're trying to understand the extent of the impact. And that can take a significant amount of time, and there are multiple factors that come into play, and you're working typically very closely with your regulator in that time frame. And if you, as part of that process, anywhere along this process, if you see something that indicates a risk sector, meaning a public health concern, then you can interim action to take action specifically to address that issue while you still do a broader investigation as part of the assessment to inform the appropriate broader corrective action. And all of this can take a very significant amount of time. It's a lot of work that goes on with the regulator too, to ensure they understand what you're seeing, and they are in alignment with the right next steps. And ultimately, even in the assessment phase, it's not like one sample, one well suddenly drives you something, unless you really see a risk to the public health. It's typical that you need multiple rounds of sampling of a given well to understand, ensure that data is reliable. And when I say multiple rounds, you're typically copying over different seasons. You know, you want to capture seasonal variations in the water, how it's behaving. You want multiple rounds of sampling so that the statistics can begin to become reliable. Background sampling, for instance, the EPA talks about 9 or 10 rounds of sampling of a background well that captures those seasonal variations. So you're easily into a couple years just to really get reliable data that supports your background determination. Then it continues to be iterative even after that. And then that will drive the next step, which is development of a corrective action that you submit to a regulator. And that too can take significant back and forth with a regulator before you land on what the right next steps are. And I would point out, because I think it is important to understand, when we say corrective action, the range of what can be corrective action is extremely broad. And a very common remedy, for instance, where there is no indication of a public health risk, is monitored natural attenuation, which means additional monitoring ongoing to ensure that risk continues to be managed, meaning the plume is stable, it's not presenting a risk, and it continues to be monitored and attenuates with time. Or it can go to an active remediation, which is more traditional of some of the things we've talked about here with, for instance, a pumping operation. So the range of corrective action can also be extremely broad. The cost can vary significantly between those different remedies. So it's very important, and the timing to implement and complete. So it's very important that investigation, that assessment phase, be very thorough to ensure that the appropriate corrective action is ultimately implemented. So that does take a significant amount of time.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. And Ms. Williams, would you turn to your pre-filed Exhibit 2?
Yes, I have it here.
And for the record, Commissioner Klofelter, that document, which I will not remark again, is RCRA, Hazardous Waste Corrective Action Facilities Remedy Selection Date document. It's in a pre-filed Exhibit 2. Can you explain to me, in regards to the conversation I just had with Mr. Wells regarding the timing that it takes from identification to corrective action, can you explain to me, Ms. Williams, what this exhibit depicts?
Yes. Well, I was trying to find a way to explain sort of exactly what Mr. Wells just discussed, which it takes a very long time once you start doing groundwater monitoring to get to a place where you know what your corrective action might need to be. And so I took data from EPA's website back in March, I think it was, and I looked at North Carolina. I also looked at South Carolina. The results are relatively similar. So there are two graphics. The first graphic looks at how long it takes for hazardous waste facilities to get from the point in time that they had all installed some type of a monitoring system, likely a one up, three down kind of monitoring system, till the time that they determined what remedy would be necessary for their site. And so what this graphic shows is that at these sites, hazardous waste sites generally put in their initial groundwater monitoring systems in 1985. And this graph shows what the median time was before they had gone through detection, assessment, monitoring, evaluated all the options for corrective action, and actually reached a final approved corrective action plan. Now, as Mr. Wells said, that doesn't mean there wasn't an interim action if something was necessary for protection of health or the environment. But the time it took to get to an approved corrective action plan, you can see the median time for 66 of the 90 facilities that are in the corrective action process, the median time was 23 years. And the graph shows sort of most of those are occurring sort of between 2007 and today, but all of these sites started with groundwater monitoring because they were hazardous waste sites back in 1985. And then the second graphic is just looking, well, once you have a corrective action plan, you still have to get the corrective action implemented, and that takes additional time. So the second chart shows that if you want to know when corrective action is finished, the median time for that, for the 24 facilities, so only 24 of the 66 facilities that had a final corrective action plan have finished implementation. And for those 24, it took 21 years. But obviously there's a lot that started in 1985 and they haven't implemented it yet. So again, my reason for putting this together is I just thought it provided a good kind of snapshot context for exactly what Mr. Wells went through. It is a very long process, but it is a protective process because of the concept of interim measures. And the regulatory agency and the company will take action to do some more limited thing anytime there's an indication that there's exposures that would result in unacceptable risks. So I think that was the intent of the exhibit.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. And does the fact that corrective action may have taken years mean that the facility owners have been imprudent in responding to the issues identified?
No, because the prudent thing to do is to make sure that your corrective action is appropriate. And that health is being protected during that process. So that is exactly how, I mean, I was involved with the design of this program back in the 80s. And that's how this program was designed. It was designed to get the right corrective action, but to make sure that you were able to take intermediate steps if necessary to protect health of the environment.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. And I think you just mentioned a moment ago about the making sure the corrective action that you steps you take are appropriate. And you were asked some questions, I believe, a moment ago by Commissioner Brown Bland regarding whether or not EPA might oppose an action taken by DEP. And I think she had used the online, putting a liner in a basin as an example. Is that an example of whether or not, and I think you said there's a different question, a better question should be asked, is the issue there that whether or not EPA opposes something doesn't mean that EPA may actually, should they in the future decide to proceed with a different method or approach, might make you redo that work? Is that a concern with that issue?
Well, certainly, again, certainly here, if a company had closed in a way that was inconsistent with how the rulemaking came out, yes, the work would have to get redone to be consistent with the rule. I mean, one doesn't know if it would be inconsistent, but it certainly could be inconsistent. I think on corrective actions, EPA, I can generally think of some examples where EPA has not wanted to see very rapid corrective action without adequate data, because EPA does not want entities to take corrective actions that would in fact potentially not adequately correct the problem. And that's why EPA wants to see significant data. They want to see risk assessment. They want to see options analysis. And that's what the states want to see too, to make sure the right remedy gets selected.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. I have no further questions, Commissioner Clawfelter.
Thank you, Mr. Marzo. Let's see if we're ready for motions relative to exhibits. Ms. Lee, I don't have an indication, and perhaps it's because my note taking was less than it should have been, that you had any additional exhibits for the witness.
No, that's right, Commissioner. No additional exhibits. Thank you.
And Ms. Townsend, I believe Mr. Marzo will be moving in the stipulated exhibits from the Attorney General's office. So I don't have a note that you had any other than that. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, and public staff, again, maybe I wasn't taking good notes, but I don't have any additional exhibits marked for you.
That's correct.
Great. My notes are so far so good. So, Mr. Marzo, we're to you.
So, Thank you, Commissioner Clodfelter. I would ask that Ms. Williams pre-filed exhibits 1 through 2, Mr. Wells pre-filed exhibits 1 through 4, Williams Wells redirect exhibit 1, all be moved into the record. I'd also ask that the stipulated exhibits, and if you need me to give you the numbers of those, I can, I'm trying to locate that, but I moved the stipulated exhibits that identified yesterday be moved into the record as well.
I had them as Duke Energy Progress 1 through 6 and Attorney General's Office 1 and 2.
That's right.
Have them correct?
Yeah, okay. That is right.
You've heard Mr. Marzo's motion with respect to the introduction of those exhibits. Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, the motion is granted. With that, Ms. Marzo, I've come to the list, end of my list of witnesses, but I believe you reserve the right to recall Ms. Bednarczyk. So I'll ask at this point if you wish to recall her.
We do not wish to recall Ms. Bednarczyk.
All right. How about let's see if we can get Mr. Wells and Ms. Williams excused. Ms. Williams may Ms. Williams, looks like you have a choice either of another cup of coffee or you might even be able to go back to sleep. So I'm sure you'd like to get excused.
Thank you. That would be wonderful.
All right. Is there any objection to excusing Ms. Williams and Mr. Wells? If not, they are excused. And thank you, with especially Ms. Williams, for being with us so early in the morning for you. We appreciate it. All right, Mr. Robinson, Mr. Mars, anything else on rebuttal?
Commissioner Clodfelter, Kamal Robinson. So nothing in particular. I think at this time, I believe we reserve the right to recall Ms. Smith as well as Mr. DeMay. So at this time, we would move to excuse them as well.
All right. You've heard the motion to excuse Mr. DeMay and Ms. Smith. Without objection, it will be so ordered. Okay. Does that conclude the company's rebuttal case then?
Commissioner Clodfelter, it does conclude the company's rebuttal case. I believe we do have a few procedural things, so you let me know if you'd like to.
We do. Let me clean up a couple first, and then I'll come back to you for the ones that you think need to be cleaned up. Ms. Downey, we have the motion by the public staff to file a corrected exhibit number 18 to Jay Lucas's testimony and did not receive any objection to that. So that motion will be granted to file a corrected exhibit 18 to the testimony of Jay Lucas.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yes, Ms. Goldstein, we also have the stipulation among Hornwood Inc., the applicant and the public staff. As I review the stipulation, it really doesn't affect any party, other parties, but I'll hear if there's an objection. If there's not an objection, we will accept the stipulation. I believe it was filed either yesterday or on Friday, one of the two.
So thank you, Commissioner Clodfelter. There's no objection from Hornwood Inc.
Right. We will accept that. It just clarifies Hornwood Inc.'s status under the appropriate tariff schedules. So we will accept the stipulation. Mr. Robinson, you may have some other things, so I'll take your other matters, but let me talk about late filed exhibits. We will, at this point, we will close the record to additional witness live testimony. And with respect to requests for late filed exhibits, Mr. Robinson, what I like to do, rather than do this piecemeal and sequentially, is I've asked Commission Counsel to circulate among all of the commissioners a list and descriptions of all of the late filed exhibits that commissioners have requested in the case. I want to be sure we've got the company a complete and thorough list. And so in the next day or two, you should expect Commission Counsel to reach out to you so that you can compare notes with the notes after conferring with all the commissioners. Be sure we got everything and nobody's left anything out. And then we'll allow you, the company, and working with Commissioner Counsel to proceed to check off that list and be sure they're all verified. So the record will remain open for receipt of those late filed exhibits. And I'm not, Mr. Robinson, I don't intend to set a deadline on that unless we think there's going to be some problems with transcript deadline and the briefing deadline, which I don't anticipate. So I'm not going to set a deadline on those, but as promptly as the company can get those back to us, that will just help all the parties with their briefing and their proposed orders. So,
Commissioner Clodfelter, if I may.
Yes. Chair Mitchell.
All right, on the issue of late filed exhibits requested by the commissioners, I'd like to request one at this time, if I may do so.
Please go ahead.
Okay, and it's the same. I made an identical request in the DEC case, Mr. Robinson. I'll just direct this to you, and you all can take care of this for me. But we'd like the total annual revenue requirement requested by DEP in this proceeding related to the recovery of the deferred CCR costs allowed by the commission in docket E2 sub 1142. Please provide citations to DEP's testimony and exhibits in this proceeding showing the calculation of this total annual revenue requirement amount and include the total NC retail amount of the deferred CCR costs allowed in sub 1142, the amount of annual amortization for those costs, and the amount of the return on the unamortized balance of those CCR costs. And then second part of the request is the total annual revenue requirement requested by DEP in this proceeding related to the recovery of the CCR costs incurred from September 1, 2017 through February 29, 2020, broken down in the same way as the previous question requested.
Understood, Chair Mitchell. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Robinson, you should anticipate that Commission Council will also have some additional similar exhibits, exhibit requests, as I indicated earlier. Anything that was requested in the DEC case will probably have a parallel request, which uses the DEP data. So you should anticipate that. And commissioners, you should expect that that will also be asked on your behalf. So except for briefing deadlines and proposed orders, Mr. Robinson, I don't have anything else, so let's hear what you've got.
Sure, Commissioner.
Excuse me, Commissioner? I'm sorry.
Ms. Force, yes.
Margaret Force, I'm with the Attorney General's Office. Just to clarify, it probably goes without saying, but all of that communication will be on the record, right, so that other parties have an opportunity if there's any concern about the requests and the responses, since we're not going to have a hearing afterward.
If you need to make motions relative to late filed exhibits, I think we've experienced that actually in the last round of cases. We'll entertain the motions, but I'm going to it's a reasonable request. I'm going to ask that Commission Counsel, once Commission Counsel has conferred with Mr. Robinson and has a good list of the finalized requests as they both understand it, that be shared with served on all the other parties. So if anyone sees anything that company counsel's missed or the commission counsel have missed, you can call it to our attention at that point, Ms. Force. Sound readable?
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Okay.
Commissioner Klotfelter.
yes. Downey. Ms. Downey.
It's been pointed out to me before we move on to final matters that there are some stipulated cross exhibits that might not have been moved in. Wells, Williams, cross exhibits 1 through 6. I'm looking at Mr. Marzo. I'm just out of an abundance of caution raising that issue.
Yeah, I thought Commissioner Klotfelter picked those up when we discussed it a moment ago. We moved them in.
I think, in fact, we did have a motion, and that was part of the motion for Mr. Marzo, was those exhibits 1 through 6. To the extent the motion was not made or was not acted upon, the motion is granted. All right, Mr. Robinson.
Derek Mertz with Commission staff.
Yes, Mr. Mertz.
During that same motion for the stipulated exhibits, I believe AGO's cross exhibits 1 and 2 were also admitted.
They were moved and they were admitted. You are correct. All right. At last, Mr. Robinson.
Commissioner Klotfelter, we just have one more. You picked up almost every other issue. I have my co-counsel, Jim Jeffries, will address it. I think there is some overlap with some supplemental rebuttal testimony for Jay Oliver that may have not been admitted into the DEC case. So I'll let Mr. Jeffries just walk through the issue and make sure that it's on the record.
Very good. Mr. Jeffries.
Thank you, Commissioner Klotfelter. In going back over Mr. Oliver's testimony, we discovered sort of a glitch in our admission of his testimony, and it resulted from the sequence and timing of update testimony filed by the public staff and then ultimately
responsive testimony filed by Mr. Oliver. As you're aware, Oliver testified on the subject of grid improvement plan during phase one of the hearing, and that terminated or ended on August 31st. A little more than a week later, Mr. Thomas for the public staff filed update testimony, and part of that testimony involves some discussion of the company's SOG enablement issues. And Mr. Oliver replied to that or filed supplemental rebuttal testimony in response to Mr. Thomas's testimony. And this is in the DEC case on September 15th, which was pursuant to commission order. And as the commission is aware, Mr. Oliver was not scheduled to testify in phase two of the proceeding, and in fact did not testify, was not called for cross-examination. Phase three, we had the same issue, but Mr. Page requested that he have cross-examination of Mr. Oliver, so we were able to get DEP supplemental testimony relating to SOG enablement, which is, you know, about four pages long, into the record. In a perfect world, we probably should have moved Mr. Oliver's supplemental rebuttal testimony in at the end of the DEC case, but we have prepared a motion which we intend to file this morning. Requesting that his DEC supplemental rebuttal testimony be allowed into the record. We've circulated among the parties. The only change or condition was a CUCA consented but wanted to move Mr. Oliver's live DEP testimony, which was Mr. Page's cross and the commission questions and my redirect, into the record in DEC, and the company doesn't have a problem with that. We've heard from every other party who doesn't object, except we have not heard from the commercial group or NCCEBA, but we intend to file the motion this morning for the commission's consideration, and just wanted to advise you of that fact.
Thank you, Mr. Jeffries. I'm terribly disappointed to hear that this is not a perfect world, but I guess I'll get over that disappointment. You've heard from Mr. Jeffries, and unless some party has an objection to the motion in the DEP case, it will be allowed. It's my intent to grant that motion when it is filed. If anyone wants to voice an objection now, I'll hear from you. We're on the record in the DEP case, Mr. Jeffries, so I'm going to have to let you make that motion separately in the DEC case, and presiding commissioner Chair Mitchell will rule on it in the DEC case. But I think we've all heard you, and so speak up if anyone anticipates that there will be an objection. But if not, it's my intent to grant the motion in this case. All right, Mr. Robinson, back to you again.
Commissioner Klaufelter, nothing outside of proposed orders and briefs.
All right. Do you have a suggestion that you'd like to put to the group?
Sure, Commissioner Klaufelter. So the company and the public staff previously conferred and proposed the due date of December 4th for the filing of proposed orders and briefs in this docket. It's my understanding this date was proposed to the parties, and I'm not aware of any objection to this proposed date.
All right. You've heard, Mr. Robinson, that the proposed date for proposed orders and findings of fact and conclusions of law and for briefs would be December 4. Anybody have any objection to that date? Going once, going twice, sold.
Commissioner Klaufelter?
Yes. I'm sorry, Commissioner Duffley.
May I hop in here?
Of course you can.
Okay. Since we're discussing the issue of briefs, When we were discussing the future coal ash recovery cost, the commission's brought up several concepts through various commissioners, and they include, but they're not limited to, the establishment of a run rate, the creation of a rider, and I believe, but I'm not positive about, a return at the cost of debt. So if any party has views on these, I request that they address those in the briefs.
A good request. So you've heard Commissioner Duffley's suggestion. If you care one way or the other on those topics, the appropriate place to express yourself would be in your proposed orders and in your briefs.
Commissioner Klaufelter.
Yes, Mr. Robinson.
Sure. Yes. I should also probably pose this to Chair Mitchell as well. Is that a request that should be bridged between both the DEC and DEP briefs, or is that a DEP specific request?
Commissioner Klodfelter, if I may.
You may.
Okay. Mr. Robinson, you all may address those issues in your briefs and post-hearing filings in the DEC case, as well as in the DEP case.
Thank you.
All right, anything further from any party? If not, I want to echo, although I'm not going to repeat, the thanks that Commissioner Chair Mitchell made at the conclusion of the DEC a portion of this hearing. I do want to though repeat the special shout out that we all should give to the IT staff and the legal staff here at the commission and public staff and at the company for making this all possible. I for one could not have conceived the possibility of the last 6 weeks back in April. It just wasn't something I could have imagined if you'd asked me to do so. So I think their heroic labors have really made it possible for us to get through these 6 weeks. And I especially want to acknowledge all of them. I don't have all the names. I can't call all the names, but you know who you are. And we owe you a special special debt of gratitude. For this phase of the case, too, I also want to thank everyone involved, the attorneys as well as all the non-attorney staff, for your innovation and your creativity in approaching the issue of the stipulations. As you can see from the result here, we've been able to process a very great deal of material and get a good record established for all parties, I think, in an extraordinarily short amount of time relative to what we might have anticipated otherwise. So you can take this one into the future and remember it for the books. Maybe you'll tell your grandchildren about having done this last 6 weeks worth of hearings, or maybe you've got something more interesting to tell them. I hope you have something more interesting to tell them when you get to that point. But again, it is a unique achievement. And I want to personally thank you again for this third phase for having made our life a lot simpler and shorter than it might have been without those stipulations. So good work to everyone. With that, we will go off the record. As I say, we will remain open for receipt of the late filed exhibits and for any post-hearing motions that any party discovers they should have made but need to make post-hearing. Thank you all. If you're traveling, travel safe. If not, thank you all. We are off the record.